Good day. Welcome to another episode of the PhD podcast. And today I have Nadine Shaban Teriyaki. Me and Nadine have known each other for over about 15 years. We've had lots of exchanges and conversations around health. The reason why I wanted to bring Nadine on is because she is everything we want in the fitness and health industry. She is a nurse practitioner who focuses on obesity and diabetes. She is a strength coach. She is a nutritionist. She is a mom. She has helped hundreds of females with their own, let's call it, body transformations and tons of experience. And she's worked in all facets of health. And I think that her experience is going to be amazing because she's done it herself, especially as a mom and a wife and going to school and trying to be a career oriented person, and just also learning more about health in the real world of working with people in the medical side, but also with your Fit Girl Strong program, right? That you're part of that team. So it's Team Strong Girls team, right? Nadine, I'm going to get right into it because you have a great resume and, you know, I want to get right into some questions here that I think are going to be really important for us. But Nadine, first I want to start with, how did you get into the fitness industry? What brought you into learning more about health? What was your marker?
I've always just been an athletic kid growing up, naturally played all sports, played varsity soccer, got injured and was not able to play anymore. So that's when I got into exercise in the weight room. And I was actually studying kinesiology at that time and was falling in love with what resistance training was doing for my mind, for my body. And I decided to do my master's in exercise physiology, studying it with type 2 diabetes and high intensity interval training. Wow. I thought it was amazing what the results could produce and really want to get in more on a clinical standpoint so I can really show lifestyle medicine and what it could do for individuals with blood pressure, diabetes, all these comorbidities that are escalating in the world, and really how like exercise truly can be medicine. So I really want to be able to help that at that clinical standpoint and to really bring that to fruition for many people. So that's what made me get into being studying nursing and then going into being a nurse practitioner.
Awesome. So a natural progression of just being an athlete into just being curious and then learning more. Obviously, your background is going to be with obesity and transformations and diabetes. Let's ask, because a lot of questions I want to ask around blood work, right? Because you see a lot of blood work of, you're going to see the people who are fit and the other side of the spectrum who are obese. Let's just start with, what are 3 to 5 markers that you think are important people should be aware of their blood work that would help them understand if they're at risk of any type of heart disease long-term?
Right. The biggest one is going to obviously be an A1C, your lifespan. So blood sugar, it's the lifespan of the red blood cells over 3 months. That's the one that's a predictor to diagnose diabetes. We use that with fasting glucose. So I would say fasting glucose, A1C, and cholesterol markers are always important in order to be able to predict someone's risk of developing any heart disease, like I said, diabetes, fatty liver, things of that nature.
And those are all standard on a regular blood work, correct? Yes. You would look at their hemoglobin A1C. What are some of the numbers that you try to keep your clients at? Because I know there's a range. So why don't you explain to us the range and how that works?
Right. So there's going to always be pre-diabetes before you get to diabetes. But I always say to my patients, it's like, there's no such thing as pre-pregnancy. You're either pregnant or you're not. Okay. So the moment someone gets to pre-diabetes, I kind of consider them a diabetic at that time and would start being a little bit more aggressive with their diet, with their exercise, instilling lifestyle modifications, trying to avoid medication if I can, but really trying to get them to change their lifestyle in order to bring those numbers down. So we want it less than 6.0 for the A1C.
On the range on the blood work, what is it? So it'll say anywhere between like 5.
A percentage. Yeah. So it'd be, you want it like less than 6.0, okay. Like in the fives. If it's in the fives, if it's in the fours, that's great. And remember, the A1C is like a snapshot of your blood sugars over 3 months. It's not like it's going to be an average. During some of the days, you could have very high blood sugars. Sometimes during the day, you could have low blood sugars. It's not a perfect picture of what's happening day to day, but it's kind of that average that we look at, that this is how your blood sugars are on average. We want it to be about less than 6%. For your fasting blood sugar, Now they do have the guidelines and what it could be and what they want to be there if you're having it fasted or after meals. But I actually say you want it to be also in the fives if you can. That would be the best predictor for your health and long-term longevity, because we always say a lower fasting blood sugar sets you up for the day to be a lot better, better controlled, better managed. And those who say you do end up getting diabetes, we always play based on what we're doing in terms of pharmacological therapy based on that fasting blood sugar. You really want to have that one the most controlled. So I like to say if it could be in the fives, that would be great. And actually, if you think about it, for gestational diabetes, they're a little bit more strict on what your blood sugar should be, and they want it to be less than 5.2. So I actually would carry that on to any individual to bring it into the fives.
It's funny. I try to tell my clients, let's try to keep it to 5.5 or under, right? Yes. That's a really good marker, 5.7, 5.8. Sometimes you'll check their blood work 3 times a year. One will be 5.4, one will be 5.7, one will be a 5.5. But generally when it's under the 5.5, you're in really good shape.
Good shape. Exactly. 100%.
When I first started in the industry, that's what, if you were over 5.5, you were considered a diabetic.
Right.
Right. I think that was like 10, 15 years ago. Has it changed? Has that marker changed as time has evolved and population has changed?
No, if anything, it just becomes more strict, right? Okay. So the numbers are actually starting to drop and not go up, because we find that having them better controlled and leading to more aggressive therapy with between lifestyle pharmacotherapy tends to have better results long term, because we know uncontrolled diabetes, which can sometimes take a while to diagnose if you're not really testing and you're just relying on that yearly blood work, it can accumulate over time. It's not something that's just going to happen overnight. It's something that's slowly progressing, and your glycemic control in order to, when you're eating and things of that nature, is just going to deter over time. We also know age is a limiting factor too. So as you age, it can get increased. So yeah, I say like, if anything, those numbers are going lower and not higher.
People wanted to just start checking their own blood sugar themselves. Do you find that the continuous glucose monitor is a great tool for them to learn more about their blood sugar? What's your experience with that tool?
I have used it just because I was curious, but my thing is I worry about people's perception of food. I find that if they just ate whole foods and balanced meals, they would be fine. They don't need to worry about that right away. Like the biggest thing is, are you moving? Are you eating fiber? Are you eating your protein? Like focusing on those things before going straight to a CGM is important, because then people will start to be like, because blood sugars are going to go up. Like, let's be real. Like every time you do eat some carbs and some, even some protein very minimally, it's going to raise. So that's just a natural progression of what happens when you eat food. It's what happens afterwards. Like, does it come back down? And are you able to maintain normal glycemic ranges like that 1 to 2 hours after you eat? Because we all know that all foods are going to increase or spike the blood sugar. So I don't really like to rely on the CGM, because we just know if someone really were to eat whole foods most of the time and have a balanced meal, like if you're having some carbs paired with some protein or some fat, then your glycemic control should improve. So like, let's just start there and start moving too. We know movement is huge for glycemic control. That's why people recommend walking after meals or some form of movement, because it helps your body bring down that blood sugar into that normal range and to utilize the blood sugars a lot better.
So you're saying it's like GM would be chapter two. Chapter one would be, let's do all the regular things. Then yeah. If it's still elevated, okay, now let's start to dig in and look for what could be something that's triggering it, because you may have a individual response to a food that you may think is good, but something could be causing the opposite for you.
Right.
In terms of your experience for nutritional strategies, because you've seen blood work, what are some nutritional strategies that you've seen help actually improve blood work?
Definitely protein. I think everyone is just deficient in protein. Mm-hmm. You're not really going to find it. Like, I mean, yeah, we can test your albumin, but it's really not going to always show if you're really that deficient in protein. I don't think anyone's really meeting that. I like to put people out usually if they can, that 1 gram per pound of body weight, if they can get there. And I find it's huge, because it helps with satiation. It helps like limiting your risk of osteoporosis, sarcopenia, which is loss of muscle, loss of bones. It's very important to eat your protein. Also having adequate fiber intake. having fiber also helps to bring down your blood sugar. So I always say, you know, that Mediterranean type style diet, if someone can get into that, but really it's just like, are you eating protein? Are you eating your fiber? And do you have some slow digesting carbs?
So could you give us an example of that, what that meal would be? I think people need to hear that because everybody has a different definition of that. So what would be a glycemic balanced meal in terms of actual food on the plate?
So thinking of, like I say, like dinner is the one that probably most people are going to be eating or struggling with. You could have some lean protein, some fish or chicken. Even I'm okay with some lean meats of steak, right? There's nothing wrong with that. And you, so you want to have that like 30 to 50 grams, depending on where you are at, at least having that for dinner. Some vegetables. So, you know, some greens. And I say color the rainbow, right? Don't be worried about like, you know, if you want some cauliflower, some broccoli, cucumbers, like whatever you want at that dinner that you enjoy to eat, because it's all about what you enjoy. That's going to cause sustainability long term. And then if you want to say a little bit of some sweet potatoes on the side, or even like your, I like to say tubers, like some parsnip. I do consider that more of a carb. Legumes, if you want some legumes, and if you can tolerate them, some people can't tolerate them because of gut health. Those are all good and high in fiber to help bring down that meal. So that would be a good complete like dinner.
What is the size of protein that you eat at your plate? Like if you were to tell us in grams or ounces, what is a serving size of protein you have on your plate?
I always have a minimum of at least 30 grams.
What would that be in ounces or in grams?
It'd be at least like, so I would have at least like my minimum, like I wake up and I'm having 30 grams of protein first thing. And then depending on how many meals I have that day, I at least have between 30 to 40 grams in each meal to get to my body weight or more. Sometimes I'll go a little bit higher, especially because of right now of pregnancy. I try to increase my protein demands for the baby, but I'm always at least a minimum of 1 gram per pound of body weight per day.
You're having a serving of about 5 to 6 ounces.
Yeah.
Like on your plate. So when you eat, you're having 5 to 6 ounces. That's a big amount, because one thing that we hear from our clients is that when they up their protein, their doctors are telling them to not eat as much animal-based protein because now we have a cholesterol and a blood sugar issue, right? How does one navigate that? I'm sure you've dealt with a client who has high blood sugar, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and then now we're saying eat more animal-based protein to help bring down your blood sugar. So you're saying, what are some of the proteins that you would recommend for that person?
I would actually stick to like more of the leaner cuts. So if you do have a cholesterol issue, you don't want to go for meats. You don't want fatty meats, right? In terms of fish, like salmon is fattier, but if you're having wild salmon, it's really not that much fattier than regular white fish, and it has good omega-3s, 6s, 9s that you do need, because you know you do need fat. Like we need fat for hormones and just for day-to-day function. So that's not something you want to limit either. I would say it's more of the fattier meats that you do need to be more mindful of. But having eggs is not going to raise your cholesterol. So enjoy your eggs. And I eat a lot of eggs myself. My cholesterol does not go up. If you prefer chicken, if you want breast, that's fine. If you want thighs, that's fine. I'm okay with any type of like chicken, turkey, any of that style of meats, any of your gamey meats. Those are also perfect. You're getting a good dose of iron in there. And like I said, your leaner cuts of steak, definitely do enjoy. There's some carnitine in there. You know, you're getting some amino acids that you always can't get from other foods. They do have each food. I always say variety. You never want to be in the same thing over and over again. Rotate your meats, rotate your like any sources of protein, fish. Like I said, fish is wonderful as well. If you have blood sugar issues or even heart issues, protein is actually going to help you. It's not something to fear. And I know that exactly from clinical practice, because if I do have individuals testing their blood sugars, I will tell you, anyone who increases their protein intake, and then they're reducing all of it, because like it does increase your satiation. It is good for your whole body in so many ways. They're actually reducing eating all that excess stuff that is going to increase their blood sugars.
It's interesting, right? Because we'll have clients come in and say, Harry, my doctor told me to cut out meat and to give up eggs. And I said, do you think that's why you hit 30% body fat, is because of eating too many eggs and too much meat? It's all the other foods. And when we make the switch from hyperpalatable processed foods and deep fried foods and high sugary items and move them towards more real food based options, you're going to see an improvement, right?
Right.
it's looking at it like taking a step back. That's why I love your experiences. It's just looking from a common sense approach. Make balanced glycemic meals. Focus on more protein. Get a lot of vegetables into your diet. Use lower glycemic carbohydrates. Move after a meal and just make sure you're multiplying that as many times as you can throughout the day.
It can be hard at first to have meat, but luckily nowadays there are other ways that you could get protein in without always having, say, meat. So if you can tolerate dairy, you know, Greek yogurt is a good source of protein, and you can always supplement with some really good shakes that are even like whole, they're similar to whole foods, right? Sometimes having them. And we utilize them a lot with our patients in the bariatric population is having a shake a day, right? Then you're just getting straight up protein, and you can even put something in there to help also with some like being more satiated too, right? Than just having a protein shake. And there's beef sticks. Like there are so many other things that you can do that it's hard at first to just consume protein. But then as you start to get used to it, your body gets used to it and tolerates it. Then you can kind of get more and more like just whole foods based. But until then, it's okay to have other sources. There's even protein breads out there that do well with some people. And I have no harm against those as well. So it's like finding the ways that work for you that can last long term. So however you're starting it is exactly how you want to finish it.
It's being conscious. I think what you're saying, the first step is just being conscious of getting protein. Look for it. Hunt for it. Then we can see how your body responds after 30 days. Yeah. If someone comes in with type 2 diabetes and high blood sugar of, let's say, 6.6 and has a high LDL and has a little bit elevated blood pressure, this isn't going to be a 2-week, 30-day fix. This is a 90-day, 120, 160-day kind of making those mini improvements. And as you start to find those options that are better, well, after 30 days, you can kind of test and say, okay, where am I now? Okay, next. And if that didn't get you the result that you want, okay, then you got to go a little bit more into digging around, right? It's going to be step by step.
And I'll tell you, I work with the bariatric population. So I do both bariatric surgery, medical weight loss. What do we prioritize with all of our patients? The first thing, we don't even care about calories. We just want you to track your protein. And that's exactly what we start. And that's the only thing we want them to track.
It's interesting, right? Because we'll have clients who see their family doctors and they'll say, lower your protein. But it's interesting from, you know, the strength and conditioning world. And then you have the longevity world and they'll say, now eat less protein. And then you've got the pre-diabetic or the diabetic obesity world. They're saying, now they're just saying, hey, let's check for protein. And at the end of the day, I think if we just take a step back, I mean, I can see in my clinical practice, the amount of people I see now over 30% body fat is probably double to triple what I saw 3 to 4 years ago.
Yeah. Right?
Here we are recommending specific diets when it's like, let's go back to the basics of just making sure there's protein at every plate, some good vegetables, you know, the zone diet. I think I think zone paleo is probably one of my favorite things to kind of go back to as let's eat real food. Let's have a balanced meal. Let's start there for 30 days and let's be deliberate in getting some movement in, deliberate in cooking your food, deliberate in what are you going to eat today? Not just, oh, I didn't cook any food last night, so I'll just wing it today. It's like, no. Let's be smart. Which restaurant are you going to? Yeah, no, this is wonderful to hear. Now, what you're saying dietary wise, balanced meals, eat more protein, see what happens in 30 to 60 days. And then from there, you can look at what's the next step to take.
Totally. Right. And even give us 90 days because you can repeat your blood work. A1C, it takes 3 months for that to change, right? So, I mean, 30 to 60 days, you should see like your own biomarkers changing, right? Like you should see the scale going down, your clothes fit. I mean, the scale, I really don't care about, but your clothes fitting looser, that you feel more energetic, like those non-scale victories that you're supposed to be focusing on, those should be changing. But then in 90 days, repeat that A1C and see where you're at.
Yes, you've got the blood work, but other things that may come up as you start to try to improve your blood work is you should be getting more energy. Your clothes will fit looser. You will start to feel better. So it's like function before composition. If you try to make your body function better, the composition will come. But if you just focus on composition and forget about the function, I say this in the office all the time. So I love hearing this. Right. Well, we just need more people talking about that, right? Now, in terms of supplementation, because I know you take supplements, right? And you've done a lot of research in them. What are three supplements that you have seen help improve people's blood work? And obviously, you'll first start with lifestyle, then chapter two. Now someone's into chapter three. You've done some things. They don't want to take pharmacological intervention. They're willing to try taking some supplements. What are three supplements that you've seen help improve someone's blood work?
It really depends on what the person's coming with, right? So what are their comorbidities? What is their struggles at the moment? I think it really depends on each individual. I don't say that there's like a blanket three supplements, but it doesn't hurt to always get in. I'm always big if they can, if they have no like blood thinners or issues. I'm always big quality of good quality fish oil. I think is always good, especially for the mind and the brain. That's why actually creatine. Honestly, I'm really big on creatine these days for many people because it helps with the muscle, it helps with the brain, it helps with cognitive function. So I'm been prescribing that a lot to my
patients.
Even
people who don't work out, just general public. Okay, what is the dosage that you're recommending? 1, 2, 3 grams?
I actually, between 3 to 5 grams, I don't do any of the loading, just take 3 to 5 grams a day because we do know it actually has a good cognitive function to it, benefit to it. And with that risk of Alzheimer's and everything going higher these days and cognitive decline increasing, that I think it's a great supplement to have. And there's a lot more benefits and something that's been studied long-term. And I know it's controversial, should people be on a multivitamin and get through food? But honestly, until someone gets to that whole food state, I'm all for someone being on a good multivitamin to cover their basis.
That's great. But those are basic, right? Like they're simple. It's like, hey, take a multi just in case. You know, we also have to understand too, is that even if someone is eating whole food, the level of stress that people go through in a day is high.
Yeah.
And, you 100%. Know, and you being a mom and, you know, just about to have your second kid, and I'm being a parent, some days I would say 95% of my clients in a week will miss 2 meals just because of life, right?
Yeah.
Having that multivitamin as a backup just to make sure.
I forgot to add protein. Obviously,
protein,
you should be
protein powder. Yeah.
Yeah, protein powder. The other thing I forgot to just mention was I like to say vitamin D, but I always like to base it on, because no one knows how to dose vitamin D.
Okay. So how do you dose it?
Well, it depends on someone's blood work, right? So, like, because there is that range that someone can go a little bit high, and you never know. So I always like to say vitamin D is important. We see it low in a lot of health issues, but it's good to just get that done. It is one that you do have to pay for. I mean, taking 1 to 2,000 IUs, even 3,000 IUs for most people is not going to hurt day to day if you don't want to pay for it. But I do recommend trying to at least see what your levels are to start, just to know kind of like how high to go.
In my whole life of working in this industry, I only had one person who had a high vitamin D. One. And it just happened like maybe a month or two ago. And she read this podcast or listened to it, and she started just taking 10,000 IU a day. And then she just never changed it. And then I'm like, high vitamin D. I'm like, how much are you taking? You're like 3 to 4? She's like, no, I've just been taking 10, because the year before she was a little bit low. So she just started taking 10, and she goes, I just never changed. I'm like, no, you can start to decrease it a little bit. All right. So now I'm going to ask you this one question that obviously you work with obesity, you work with type 2 diabetes, and that magic word out there that everybody's using now is Ozempic. Right. And I would love to get your experience with it, because you're actually working with that demographics that are probably going to benefit from using it, right? So give us your experience, like minus all the research and everything. I always say like, yeah, research is great, theory is great, but what are your experiences with it? I have my own experience with it with our clients, but I'm very curious to kind of get your explanation and uses around it.
I've actually been using it way before it kaboomed on social media.
Okay.
And for the right person and the right individual, it is fantastic. Again, it's a medication. And I always say medication, surgeries, anything you do, it's a tool in a toolbox. They work great as long as you work with it. I do see non-responders. So I just want to put it out there. Ozempic does not work alone. You cannot take it and you cannot just lose weight by taking it and not watching what you eat, not exercising. You have to put in the work. All those individuals that have results with it, they're also doing something to put in the work in order for it to work effectively. Because I have taken people off of it and I'm like, you're not a responder. There's no point in continuing to use it, right? But for those that are willing to have some lifestyle modifications, sometimes they just need that extra step. I always say, if someone is in an overweight if they're in an overweight population, their brain is always fighting them to be at that highest weight point. For some of us to lose 5 to 10 pounds, it's okay. It's easy. But for others, it's very hard to get started and motivated because the body is always trying to push them back to the highest weight that they have been on. So this medication helps to go and act on the brain to help food consumption, but also with help changing that set point in the brain. And it gives them that motivation just to actually start, you know, exercising, starting to eat better, because then they can start to see some results that they weren't able to see independent of this. That's when that medication is a great tool and works perfectly, because it gets the individual to be motivated to help change their body and help to like reset their physiology.
What year did you use Ozempic? What was the first year that you used it?
Before Ozempic, there still is, because there's Saxenda, there's Trulicity. Mm-hmm. There are other GLPs that we were able to use, but Ozempic came about, it was like 3 or 4 years ago.
Wow, okay. Because now it's big, right? 3 or 4 years ago. So you have lots of really good, obviously you've seen really good success with it, right?
And like I said, it's something that people have to work with. So you can take it, but I know people who, like I said, if they're not going to change how their eating habits are and they're just non-responders, then as medical professionals, we do not keep them on it because they're not getting results. Yes. Now, taking any medication has side effects, without a doubt. It can cause nausea, it can cause vomiting, diarrhea, but that's also when people don't know how to take it properly, or they're not changing their eating patterns, because if they really are going to go eat a non-nutritious, nutrient-dense food, like say, have not just a little bit of cake, but a lot of cake, the body is not going to like it, and it will feel sick afterwards. If you're not slowly dosing it up correctly, you can have side effects, feeling more nausea, more vomiting, diarrhea, or constipation can kind of go either way, because it does impact the gut hormones. But that's not something you always see long term. Usually it's just when someone starts out with it and the body adapts to the medication. But again, that's like really anything you're putting into your body that's not whole foods, there's a risk of having any of those feelings associated with it.
You think it's a good medication because it gets people going in the right direction. And if they work with it, it can be very beneficial. But if you're not going to change anything to go with it, like I can tell you, even in our experience in our office, we've had clients who have used it and gained weight. We've had clients who have used it and felt sick. And then we've had clients who have seen success with it, right? I always tell my wife when she asks me about it, I said, it's like 50-50, either works or it doesn't, you'll know within a month. Right. Yeah. That's kind of what I've noticed in my office. I'm like, within 30 days, you'll know whether it's working or not, but each individual has a different reaction to it for sure. Right. All right. So last question before I let you go here is, what are three things that you do for your health every day that are non-negotiables for you to feel the utmost best?
I love movement. Yeah. I have to do some form of movement. I either walk to work. I put a lot less stress on my body, like my mind these days, that it doesn't have to always be an intense workout. It doesn't always have to be, you know, something structured, just movement in general. So if I'm walking to work, taking the stairs at work, just doing something with my son, that any type of movement is a win in my part, and it has to be something I do daily. Secondly, is obviously getting my protein in. I know if I'm not eating adequate protein, I don't feel optimally, and actually it can change my mood as well. I have more energy. I just feel a lot better with protein. And my third thing is gratitude. I always have to wake up and have gratitude with my husband, with my son, and just with life in general, because I always believe that any health marker starts in the brain, right? When we have that positive mindset, appreciation, and just gratitude for life, it sets us up for success with whatever life throws at us.
You know, Charles always used to talk about that gratitude. And I was always like, what is he talking about? I'm like, this guy's the biggest meathead in the world. And, you know, it's probably in the last year or so I've started practicing it. And I always say to people, life just becomes easier.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. That's great. Well, thank you very much for sharing with us all of your information. And
you.
And I know that you're due any time in the next 3-4 weeks. So I wish you luck with your baby and being a mom. And I appreciate you taking time. And obviously, with your energy levels being very carrying a baby and having a young one, I appreciate you taking the time to share with us all this information. And I hope people really benefit from this. So thank you.
Love it. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure, Harry.
All right. Thank you very much and have a good day.